Okay, so recording 18, we're back in the second half of the lecture and we're doing a double recording, so this hopefully is going to get out onto the wider world. So we're starting Heidegger's almost meditation into what is the mathematical, because he thinks that his view is that in some sense the mathematical is the principle that is in a way determining modern science, and that to get to grips with what is determining modern science we have to go back to the Greeks. But as I was saying earlier, that's Heidegger's understanding anyway of all of our philosophy comes out of the Greeks. Even the word philosophy, even the idea of philosophy comes out of the Greeks. So that I don't know if I was recorded saying this or not, but in a way he wants to bring us all back to the place the Greeks were when they first thought what they thought. He sort of, it's almost like that's the ground of what it is to be a philosopher. And that's where we can put into question what it is we do think, because we get back to that place of the origins, a place of origins. And Heidegger, the later Heidegger especially, is in quest of thinking, and he means something elusive. The quote that we had from before, and from what is called thinking, the book itself starts with the most thought-provoking thing in our thought-provoking times is that we're not thinking yet. So there's a certain place that Heidegger is coming from where he's suggesting, or not even suggesting, he's asserting that what we call thinking, particularly in science, isn't thinking. Not in the sense that he means it. It's some way that the way I understand that actually is that the kind of thinking that occurs in science is a sort of calculation. Something that, if you want to say, well, what is a calculation? Something that can be done according to rule. You don't need a human discrimination to calculate. That's why you can calculate with a computer. So this is quite an interesting... It interestingly connects with our modern understanding of what intelligence is and what thinking is, and our idea that we're going to develop artificial intelligence that is going to be doing our thinking for us, because it's going to be far more capable of being rational than we are. Heidegger would say, and does say, that's not thinking. And the interesting thing, I guess, in our world is there is a large group of people, again, the influential people in the universities and in government and in power, who would have no idea what it would mean to say that thinking rationally is not really thinking. So there's a sort of a background there. Heidegger wants to get back behind not just the scientific, but behind the mathematical, which in a sense is the rational as well. This is where he differs from Husserl. Husserl, in a way, wants to remain within the rational. But it's not at all clear to us, I hope, or I suspect, what it means to be rational. We have a way that we use the word. We could say, oh, you're being very rational, as opposed to you being, say, emotional or sentimental, or that being rational represents a certain mode of being that we can recognise. But it's one of these things where, well, it's almost like a capacity that would be hard for us to articulate. What does it really mean to be rational? And somewhere in Heidegger's thinking about science is that it's essentially rational and the rational is something essentially mathematical. And certainly modern logic has borne that out in the distinction between the idea, the formal idea of what it is to be rational is embodied in the rules of logic. And the distinction between logic and mathematics, which was there at the Scientific Revolution, they were two different disciplines, if you like, they've come together in the 20th century, so that now, although we can say there's mathematics and there's logic, at the highest level, they've been unified, so that there's no... to think rationally is to think logically, is to think mathematically, have all become equivalent. And a short way of defining it for me, given my world, is to think logically, to think rationally, to think mathematically are all ways of thinking that it would be possible to program a computer to do. In terms of arriving, you know, that kind of thinking arrives at a certain destination. And it arrives at that destination by following rules. And if a certain kind of thinking follows a set of rules that inevitably leads it to a certain destination, then you can write a computer program that will do that. And that's what the vision is, if you like, of artificial intelligence. Because human thinking, logical thinking, can only, like playing chess, can only see a certain number of steps ahead. And if it's just a matter of following rules, then we can create computers that can follow rules, that can see many, many, many steps ahead of an individual human mind. So you can see there's a... what we're talking about here, about the rule of the mathematical, in a way was still a little bit theoretic in Heidegger's time, but the current concerns about artificial intelligence are indicating that these questions about what is the mathematical, what does it mean to think mathematically, what is intelligence, are going to become actual matters of concern for us in our actual lives. For instance, just interestingly on Radio 4 recently, somebody is already thinking about writing a computer program to decide in a car accident who is going to die. Obviously, right? Who's going to die? Who's going to die here? Someone's going to die, right? Things have got so bad now, and this program's in control of the car, right? It's coming. Who's going to die? You, the driver? Or those five people on the... I mean, generally, I think it will run an algorithm that says if you're going to die, the driver, or the five people on the pavement, probabilistically, you know? And it'll be probabilistic. There's a 50% chance that the five people on the pavement are going to die, and 100% chance that you're going to die if we take course two. So that's one life, 50% chance of five, 2.5 lives, you die. We're going to be writing programs. Somewhere in that code, there's going to be... So that's what I mean. You know, we're already at the point now where the drones are going to be autonomous. At the moment, there's a human being saying, all right, kill. But that we can see easily that there are definitely regimes that get a hold of that technology aren't going to bother with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the drone goes. So the idea of our artificial intelligence actually functioning and operating and taking decisions in this world, not just shall I buy X or Y, but life and death decisions, it's already there. Do you see there's a certain... I'd like you to see there's a certain stream here about us having accepted that thinking mathematically and thinking, which is thinking rationally, is what it means to be intelligent, is a course of action which is already leading to us handing over our decision-making powers to calculating machines, because in a certain sense that mathematical understanding of what it is to think already has surrendered something, yes, that leads to that, and that surrendering isn't about to happen in the future. That surrendering, that understanding of intelligence, is a part of our heritage. And people are going to act like they've just made all this up, just thought it all through this week, you know. But no, it's all been thought through for us by a certain course of action that we took. I'm just giving you this as a kind of we're not just looking at the past as if it's done and dusted, right? The ideas of this past are still determining how we live now. I'm giving you a dramatic example, right? I mean, that's right. Because the whole autonomous car thing, right? What is it, Elon Musk and the, you know, his Tesla cars? Yeah, it's coming. It's coming without a, of course, that's a great idea. Because the argument is going to be, and it's going to be a rational argument, fewer people are going to die. But I've gone on a roll now. Actually, what that means from the point of view of the code is fewer machines are going to be destroyed. The code has no idea what it means to die. The code actually has no idea what it means to destroy a machine. It's just following a rule. But the are you getting a little insight maybe into that a certain understanding of intelligence is at play here as well, that in science? It isn't just, we start from saying we're going to put subjectivity aside, and we end up with cars that are deciding who's going to die.
Ignoring sentience, and in thinking, planning.
But we've got to be fair. Newton and Galileo, and Kepler, and Boyle, and Descartes, were not ignoring sentience. How we got to where we are now, there's more to the story, right? Definitely weren't. All they were saying is, there's this physical realm, and then there's the realm of the spirit, of consciousness, of soul, whatever you want to call it. But something happened to the second realm subsequently. I feel we need to trace what happened there as well, you know, because we've ended up by default with a view of things that essentially, when you look at it, is absurd. And it doesn't take a genius to see that. Anyway. So, Heidegger wants to say that mathematics, as far as the Greeks are concerned, let's go back to, is what can be learned and what can be taught, the learnable. Somebody who's a philosopher loves knowledge. A philomath is someone who loves learning. And the word still lives on with polymath. If you know, a polymath is someone who's yes, has but loves learning. So is a kind of a polymath is someone who knows about a number of different fields because of a love of learning. So there's a link here, I think, where what the Greeks mean by mathematics and what we mean by mathematics has gone through a considerable change. So Heidegger's going back to this original meaning and trying to draw a kind of a line through it. So he's saying that numbers aren't mathematical in terms of that's not what mathematics is. It's some mathematics is something more than just number. And now he's making some statement that means that mathematics becomes something very hard to grasp. This is where I start to lose track of Heidegger in a way. he's saying that mathematica are the things insofar as we take cognizance of them as what we already know them to be in advance. The body is the bodily, the plant-like of the plant, the animal-like of the animal, the thingness of the thing. That's what we were talking about earlier, right? It's what we already bring. It's what we have to understand before we can understand anything in particular. It's the understanding that we're unaware of, really, in our day-to-day working with things. It's already operating, it's already functioning in us. So there's a sense in which we know it, and yet we don't know it. We know it because it's operating in us. So mathematical learning is a matter of learning what you already know, but you didn't know you knew. Which sounds to me a lot like philosophy. Yes, it's becoming cognizant in philosophy is becoming cognizant of stuff that was operating in you, like the way that perception is structured. If you remember when we were looking at Husserl about how, when we listen to a sound, how it's retained. The immediate past of the sound is retained, and about how we're pretending or projecting every moment, we're expecting the future. We don't live with the knowledge of pretension and retention and how time works in us, but we know it, right? As in, when you look at it, when you examine it, when it's pointed out to you, you're discovering what you already knew, what was already functioning in you. So he's trying to say that the mathematical is something like this. I mean, there are philosophical questions about where does that come from? Are there such things as innate ideas that we somehow are there before we become conscious? Or does all of this, this mathematical background, is it formed in us as a result of experience? Does it grow as a result of after we're born? And this is the great argument between the rationalists and the empiricists at this time. The empiricists, the English were the famous empiricists who thought of us as blank sheets, and that all of the ideas we got from our experience after being born. Whereas the rationalists, of whom Descartes was a member, thought there were pre-existing ideas. I think that current thinking, since Kant, is that yes, there is some kind of inherited structure of perception. If you're a pure materialist, you would say that inherited structure is the material reflection of it is the structure of your brain and your body. You know, your brain and body is structured in such a way. So in a way, your understanding, your basic understanding, is already pre-delineated by the structure of your body and your nervous system. But an idealist would say, no, there actually are ideas in a pure realm, immaterial realm of ideas that are available to us in our being. Our consciousness is in contact with a realm of ideas that aren't material. All of that, we're not saying is that right or wrong. We're saying Ta Mathematica is to do with that, is to do with the discovery of what we already know, whether it is from what we've picked up from our culture and our childhood and our upbringing, or whether it's in some sense a learning about this realm of ideas. For the Greeks, it certainly, for Plato, it was a realm of ideas. That was his whole idea of philosophy was this very idea that you only discover what you already knew because the ideas are in you already.
Hegel, is not.
So, pardon?
Hegel.
Let's not mention Hegel now. No, that's not Richard Hankel. He's another figure. I'm confused about Hegel. I'm confused as in I rejected Hegel very strongly, and yet every now and then I have to say, well, there was something in his dialectics. Yeah, but so I don't want to start. So true learning occurs only when the taking of what occurs only where the taking of what one already has is a self-giving and is experienced as such. And in a way, I feel like Heidegger's going on a bit of a detour here, but I think there's some truth in this. Teaching, therefore, does not mean anything else than to let the others learn. Isn't that a nice way to put it?
Yeah, I really liked that when I read that.
Yeah.
I thought that was really very true.
Yes. Or at least there's only ever any enjoyment in it when it's like that. You know, when teaching is someone's trying to stuff something into you, you know, learn it, you know. I mean, the worst form being just remember these facts or learn this technique. Practice. But the kind of learning that we engage in philosophy is a different sort of thing, right? It's an endeavour to recognise something that, in a sense, you don't have to learn it, you see it. And when you see it, you have the sense, but I already knew it. But I hadn't. The difference is, I hadn't brought it up into my self-reflective awareness before. And it's the very action, you know, of bringing something up into your... And you, that's it. It's a self-giving. You know, I can say whatever, I can talk about stuff that I've brought up into my self-reflective awareness. But that doesn't mean anything, right? The whole process, in a way, here is maybe something I'm saying is going to trigger something off in you, and it brings something up in you that you haven't seen before. Because if you've seen it before and you've made it explicit, in a way, you're just going around the same circle. You know that, and the whole point of philosophy is you're not going around the same circle. Here, there's something new, but in a way it's not new. It's quite, you know, it's Hegelian. There's a dialectic.
So a lot of what is taught is not mathemata, because like another language or something.
Yes.
You can't possibly know that in advance.
No.
So anything that kind of contains information you didn't know before.
Yes. I mean,
I
must have been a philosopher of some sort, because for me, when I was at school, things were very strongly delineated like this. I used to enjoy mathematics because it wasn't like French or history, where I had all these facts that I had to just kind of eat and restore, you know, and practice with. I used to sit in my maths classes, and, you know, Mr. Knight was my exemplar, really, as a teacher. He used to just go up on the board and he'd say, look, you see how this works with this triangle and this angle there and this angle there? And I'd just sort of sit there, and then finally I'd either go, yeah, got it, or no, I better look at it some more. But there was no stuffing it in. There's just the moment where you say, yeah, got it. And that for me was, that's why I started off taking maths at uni, because it wasn't work. I found all the rest of it was a kind of a form of suffering. Do you know? Whereas mathematics has that quality that you're not suffering, you're just discovering something that was already within you, in a way. That knowledge was already within you. And philosophy is like that too. Genuine philosophy. Not philosophy where you have to learn what so-and-so thought. What did he think? And you go, what's that term mean? You know, there's an aspect of philosophy where you're just learning what someone else said. Philosophology, as you remember. But genuine philosophy, I'm glad I'm getting this on tape, is like mathematics. It's that discovery of something that you already knew. And this is way back, you know, Plato knew this. It's amazing, really. But that sense of the mathematic is much, much broader, and for me it includes philosophy. And I don't feel in this particular piece that Heidegger's writing that he really narrows it down. How do we go from that terribly broad, you know, because Ta Mathematica is there in all of us all the time, yes? There's something about modern science and modern mathematics that is much as just an aspect of that. And I'm not sure that Heidegger really grasps what it is that distinguishes modern mathematics from this Greek idea of mathematics, because it's got a very different character. I've underlined something here which I think is the crucial point, but I don't think Heidegger makes it. So we can now understand why number is something mathematical. We see three chairs and say there are three. What three is, the three chairs do not tell us. Rather, we can count three things only if we already know three. Yes, good. Numbers are the closest to that which we recognise in things without deriving it from them. So, I find that it's interesting that Heidegger said that. So the mathematical is what we don't derive from things. But I find that that's all very questionable, because there's a sense in which I think we did derive what three is from things originally.
When I say there are three cups there, that I'm just repeating my idea of three that I know,
yes.
I'm not understanding the cups.
No, and you're not getting it from the cups. The fact there are three is already in you, but at one point in your life, in your very early life, it wasn't.
And there are societies that don't have words for numbers.
Yes.
So presumably they don't have it.
Yes, but a Platonist would say, well, there's just societies who haven't discovered that realm of pure idea. But phenomenologically speaking, like Husserl, although I haven't read his arithmetic writings, he would describe how the number three kind of arises from our phenomenological interaction with the world. We just recognise, an awful lot of our sensory experience, don't like to use that word, our life experience, is a matter of detecting or recognising what things have in common. You know, we recognise what a cup is because over time we've recognised, yeah, they're things we can pick up and drink out of. Do you know, there's something that unifies cups. There's something invariant about all of these things that are different that unifies them. So the whole process of our developing the idea of a cup is an abstraction. Yes? A number is just a kind of ultimate abstraction. You know, it's saying I've got, you know, what have they got in common? Well, there's something. There's something they've got in common, right? You see? But it's very, very, you see the thing that says, oh, well, they're both for drinking from, that's at a certain level of abstraction. But to finally get the idea that they've got something in common, I mean, the mathematicians who thought about it said, yeah, there's an actual thing here where we can, and there's none left over. Yeah, that's another way of putting it, you know. But finally, you get to the idea of three. But you know, whether it's what the number of three is, you have to have done all this stuff somewhere as a child to get it, right? But that doesn't mean that maybe you have to do all that to get in touch with number, the idea of number that does, in some sense, also pre-exist us. You know, it's a fascinating, you know, not unanswerable even, possibly. I mean, I always favour if there are two options, they must both be true. But that's a safe way of progressing, you know. Both have some truth in them. So the gist of Heidegger is saying, look, we get this without deriving it from them, but that doesn't mean that we didn't once derive these ideas from things. It's almost like it's the store of stuff that you've got in you that you aren't deriving directly from what's in front of you, but that is structuring what you experience. And that's a very, very broad area. So the mathematical is that evident aspect of things within which we are always already moving, and according to which we experience them as things at all and as such things. And I was saying that to you earlier, Maria, yes, that it's we're looking at this level of, without that, there'd be no things. And Heidegger's trying to, that's what he means by saying something that the thingness of things just sounds absurd to a certain level of us, doesn't it? But it's not, if we get down low enough with it. And then we leap, right? We take a leap, and Heidegger takes a leap here where he said, oh, that's what the Greeks meant by it. Now let's look at modern science. And in a way, he doesn't join the dots. But modern science, for him, he's just taken, you know, Husserl took Galileo. Heidegger, very generously, given the German that he is, he hardly ever acknowledges an Englishman. He's prepared to acknowledge Newton because of this principle of inertia. That Newton, Newton's great. I think Galileo's had an idea of inertia as well. What Newton did in his Principia was to set up these basic laws of motion in a way that he used them as the basic foundational axioms for the understanding of the whole universe. Yeah. So Galileo didn't do that. Although he employed the idea of inertia and he started to mathematize things, it all came together in Newton's Principia book and the laws of motion, from which he is going to deduce how the universe works. Yes.
So I have a question about the stages of like Galileo and then Newton and then Einstein. When Einstein doing these experiments, was Heidegger aware?
Oh yeah, Heidegger's aware of Einstein. So Heidegger at this point, he's writing in the 50s, but he was current with relativity and with quantum mechanics. But whether he understood them mathematically or not, I probably not. Probably the only famous philosopher who was also could be said to truly understand the physics was Alfred North Whitehead. He's an interesting an interesting figure in his own right, which I don't know we're going to have time to go into him, because he's interesting in this domain of, he's another interesting philosopher, not as famous as he ought to be, but he may be having his day now, you know. But we won't go into Alfred. With the first law of motion, so for those of you who were doing home economics, you probably didn't get this drilled into you, you know, because this is...
never seen that.
You've never seen it before. No. Oh, got it. Bang, 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 bang. In my school, there were three laws of motion. I've forgotten them. But
action and reaction.
Yeah, action and reaction are equal and opposite. Yes, that was one of them, wasn't it?
Is it a pair?
Yeah.
Did you
learn that?
Yeah, the whole thing was a nightmare for me. The physics.
Federico, do you remember
that?
I liked religion.
No. You don't get the first law of the Newton's three laws of motion, which I've forgotten. But if they were, like, as soon as you mention them, they're a bit tar mathematicalish, you know, like they're in me somewhere.
What age did you learn them, John? Do you remember?
Oh, must have been straight away. You know, almost 12, 13, secondary school.
Trying to think, or secondary school. Yeah.
Anyway, the. The question is, it doesn't matter whether you learn them or not. I think you'll find that you do, in some sense, they've informed you. So let's see if they have. So everybody continues in its state of rest or uniform motion in a straight line unless it is compelled to change that state by force impressed upon it. This is called the principle of inertia. What's my answer to the principle of inertia? Or this is a medieval answer. It would be. What do you mean? Well, I'd say it's rubbing against the table. Oh, okay then. What do you mean? Goes on straight line. It's just, you know. Everybody, if you push something, it'll absorb in some sense the force that you've given it. It'll accelerate to a certain speed and then just carry on moving in a straight line for all eternity. That's what it says. Have you gone? You see how you're laughing. This is what the medieval people thought when they got the law of inertia. I mean, you must be balmy, right? Yes. To suggest such a thing. Subsequently, I guess, we've seen something like somebody up in a space capsule pushing something, and it actually does that, right? Have we all seen the images of the people up in space? You know, once you get out of the gravitational field of the Earth, it bing, and, pushing something very heavy and very light, going boom, and they just move off together. There are shots of, because finally, once you get into space, you've got a sort of a situation where you can actually demonstrate that. When you first saw it, I don't think you would be really shocked, not really shocked, right? You've been softened up in a way, softened up by why? How? Well, by the fact that that Newton's laws of motion have been accepted and seek through our culture, right? The idea. I mean, for me, I've got to bear in mind your profoundly inadequate education, because I actually think you ought to be told these things. I think it's valuable to understand where the ideas that structure, even if you don't like it as a child, it's very informing later on to have known about your own history. I mean, we live in a world now where that's all kind of rubbish, forget it. But you see, if it actually has structured your thought and you don't know anything about it, what hope have you got, right, to in any way become aware of it? You know, especially in a world where whatever happened in 2007 was irrelevant, virtually, isn't it? Where's our history start? Around the financial crisis, isn't it? Before that, nothing. Don't really need to know, do you? There's a certain sense that that's how our culture works now. You know, if you watch radio, listen to Radio 4, you get a bit of history, but who listens to Radio 4? I mean, the media, right? The media, the news, it basically has got about a one day of attention, hasn't it?
The media's getting especially this after truth. Now we don't know, is it YouTube the truth? Is it the BBC the truth?
I know, it's quite... You see, I used to feel the media was like
post-truth.
Was the media having a stranglehold on the information, so that you could very hard for anyone to get out. If they had a new idea, it's very hard to get. You have to get the media really to accept the great establishment of the media or the academic establishment. There's all these establishments that if you wanted to get any kind of idea out, it had to get through their gates. And that, you know, think that's terrible, and the internet comes along, you think that's great, you know. No longer do we have to go through all these stuffy, prejudiced institutions. And now you start to see how it's turning out, and you think, oh, I see what they were there for now. You know, the gatekeepers, they may have kept everything suppressed, but they also kept things within order, within certain bounds. And we're starting to experience now the loss of structure, the loss of the ability to distinguish between what's true and what isn't, that was already there in most people, you know. Most people can't distinguish between what's true and what isn't. So they're told, you know, by the BBC. And the BBC doesn't always get it right. And the BBC has a certain kind of background, like science, where it's projecting a certain understanding of the world, which basically says, you know, if you're British, you're doing pretty well, you know. If you're in the Middle East, well, never mind. You know, that's a sort of short version of the BBC, isn't it? But very reasonable, you know, basically reasonable.
But not the World Service.
Do you listen to the World Service? Yeah, my dad used to, he was an engineer that, he was involved in broadcasting the World Service to the Middle East. He used to go out to an island in the Persian Gulf, which was a radio station that just designed to propagate what some people would consider British propaganda. that's a big digression, isn't it? So the law of inertia was not self-evident, and I think we got the idea right. It's still a bit hard to believe, but it represented a complete revolution in our understanding of how the world works that becomes mathematical. In what sense mathematical? Well, we have to see, because this is, remember I underlined getting something from the things themselves, understanding things from the things themselves. The Aristotelian understanding of physics, if you like, was much more from the things themselves. It was much more based, if you like, on our immediate experience of how things are. And we started to generalize in a much more naturalistic way from how we experience things to how, we made inferences and generalized from experience to produce a picture like this. Right, this is the Aristotelian worldview. A purely earthly body moves downward. The purely fiery body moves upward. What about a fire? Yeah. Up it goes. Right. You've got to suspend gravity. You see, Newton, when he suggested gravity, he was very uncomfortable. Because what's gravity? A kind of a magical, invisible force at a distance. Yes? How does it operate? Where is it? That's what I mean as a child. If you get an idea in a child, it's like Catholicism. You get it in early enough. Gravity, no worries. Why does this fall? Because of gravity. Well, what's gravity? Yeah. Well, it's the thing that makes it fall. Well, how do you know? Well, I just know. I can see it. Well, you can't, can you? You can't see gravity. Gravity is an extraordinary mystery. So somehow or other, it's pulling everything down. Not everything, though. For the Aristotelians, it's not everything. Because it doesn't pull the air down. Otherwise, all the air would be down on the ground and we'd be suffocating, right? So it doesn't pull air down. It doesn't pull fire down, right? Fire goes shh. And water is not quite pulled down, right? Water's on the surface of the earth, but it's not sucked into the earth, right? It's able to survive, and it's not solid. It's got a fluidity. And these basically are if you're looking at it qualitatively, these are the sort of four basic states of matter, which we, earth, air, and water are like gas, solid, and liquid as they become in science. But for us on Earth, we start with the obvious thing that everything on the Earth falls towards the Earth that is earthly. And why does it do that? Well, not because of some stupid invisible power. You know, the reason that things fall is because it's their nature to fall. We don't hypothesize something else. We say that earthly things, it's just in their nature to fall. They're not quite alive and they're not quite dead. You know, we haven't quite got the notion of dead matter yet. We've got the notion that earthly things including us, because we're sort of an earthly thing, we all share a certain nature. And it is in our nature to be attracted to the earth. Not because of the earth is attracting us, or there's some force, or there's some gravity. It's just the way it is if you're an earthly body. And what's the proof? Well, you just look at all the earthly bodies. They all fall towards the earth. You see, we're reasoning from how things appear into to us. Now, not everything falls towards the earth that's earthly. But if you don't fall towards the earth, like a rock when you throw it, it's because you've been thrown. Yes, you've got a kind of a... you've had some kind of movement imparted to you that is against your nature, which is violent. So that was the Aristotle and considered this to be violence. The later people in the Middle Ages had some crazy ideas about how things were able to move. They had an explanation for how arrows move, is that as they move, they create a vacuum in the air behind them as they're moving, and the air has to rush round the thing you've thrown and fill the vacuum, but it makes another little hole as it's going round. So the reason that things can move through the air is because there keeps being a vacuum behind them, and that's how we go, right? That's what happens, so it's not as if you've got a force that's been given to you. It's that as soon as you're moving, that you create a certain vacuum that enables you to keep moving, because you're actually moving in nothingness, but it wears out. All violence, the violent impulse, only lasts so long. There's no friction. There's no idea of friction and force or anything like that. It's all to do with the nature of the body, and you violently changed the earthly body's wish, almost, to be with the earth. But it's that's why it falls, is it slowly gets rid of that.
On TV, it looks like the bodies are moving, but it's just the pixels are the lighter.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe it's something like that.
Yeah, well, no, the vacuum reminded you of that, right? Didn't it?
Yeah,
we're just sort of shifting little bits around.
It's not the same thing that's moving.
There's no force in a movement of something across the screen, is there?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're getting the idea, right? As when you see, we're so imbued with the nature, with this idea of force operating, this invisible thing, that we get. You see, we experientially, though, it's not that we made it up. Experientially, just holding your hand up, you kind of feel there's something pulling it down. But the Aristotle lands and say, no, do you feel in your hand? It's in your hand, the feeling of wanting to go down. Do you get it? It's phenomenological.
Mm-hmm.
You lift your leg up like that, after a while, you should try it. I'm getting it right now. It's my foot wants to go down. It's not being drawn by some force. It just doesn't like it up there. Yeah? It's tired. It doesn't... thank God. You see? It's almost like you're coming out of your experience of your body and saying it's like that for everything, right? Because we're all earthly bodies. But then, if you look into the sky, there's something else up there, right? All of the stars and the moon and the sun... they're all perfect. The moon appears as a perfect sphere, and so does the sun, right? There's no telescopes or anything to indicate anything different. And all the stars move in these perfect arcs across the sky. And nowhere on Earth do we see any movement like that. Not that kind of perfection that you see So clearly the celestial realm is an entirely different realm to the Earth. And also clearly, it's all going round the earth, and the earth is the centre of it all. And celestial matter, I mean, they wouldn't have even called it matter, but the celestial bodies are not earthly, obviously. Dimwit, you know, you feel like, obviously, because if they were, they'd all fall to earth, wouldn't they? Yeah? Wouldn't they? They just fall to earth. Shoop, doop, doop, doop. All of the stars would just go, boom. Right, the moon, the sun, they just go, boom. They just fall to earth.
The sun's fire, though, so it goes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's but no, I guess because Newton's about to say the sun's made of earthly matter too, so because we aren't even thinking like that. I mean, we're not even thinking that they have any weight in the sense of weight, because weight isn't an idea that we had in that way, that something has weight because of gravity. But what does hold them up? Well, at that point, well, they're actually supported on spheres. So the planets and the stars, they're all actually attached to spheres that are turning. Of course, the planets, they do weird stuff, right? They're moving across the sky like they're stars, and then they turn backwards. If anyone ever bothered to watch the stars, the planets, and how they move in the sky at night, Venus and Mars do all kinds of weird kind of gyrations as we pass them. You know, we understand it now in this other way. You know, as the Earth moves around, we overtake certain planets and they overtake us, and we're all moving at different. So the way that the planets move to us has some strange gyrations in it. And in this earlier view of the world, this was also something that needed explaining, right? Because the fixed stars are all moving in a sphere. We can clearly see that. But the planets are doing something else. They're very interesting. The wanderers, that's what it meant, the word planet.
There is something in common between the stupid medievals and the intelligent scientists, that both rely on their observation.
Yes. Oh, yes. And I mean, the Ptolemaic view, which was of the idea that the planets are on these spheres, had the idea of epicycles, which is that the planets, unlike the stars that are on a fixed sphere, are actually on spheres that have spheres within them. So Mars is like turning in a sphere, but in that sphere is another sphere in which Mars is turning as it goes around this bigger sphere. And it turns out that you can construct a model that explains all the movements of the planets. And, of course, they did that to a level of exactitude that matched you. How it wasn't that easy to observe the stars without a telescope or the planets. But the model of the epicycles was able to explain and predict what the planets were going to do. So we had a perfectly good model. And then science comes along, Newton and Galileo, particularly Galileo to begin with, and suggests that, this was the big thing that started it all off, that the Sun is the centre of the solar system, and the Earth goes around the Sun, and so do all the other planets. I mean, what are you thinking, right? How could that possibly work? There's no spheres, and all the planets are just made of the same stuff as the Earth? I mean, are you mad? What's holding them up? I mean, do you see? Here, all right, let's try it. You know, I've got two things here. One's going to go around the other. How? Anything that you try and do that, it just falls to the Earth. So why isn't the Moon falling to the Earth? If the Sun is a big body, why isn't everything falling into the Sun? You know, it's just... So this first law of motion and the whole story that Newton is trying to explain is basically going to say, or is saying, that all of this idea of there being celestial stuff, earthly stuff, earth, fire, water, it's all rubbish, and it's all just the same stuff. Yeah, it's just stuff, what they called corpuscles, which became atoms, spread out in space. And that's all there is. Now, can you see at that point in time, there was no justification whatsoever from any kind of empirical evidence to say that? I mean, one of the things that started it off was it seemed like, yes, it has to be that the planets are going around the Sun, because instead of this extraordinary set of epicycles that try and explain what's going on, as soon as you put the sun at the center, then everything becomes very simple. Yes? And it's almost like this is how science progresses. So you start by saying, well, if it were that way, what are the consequences? The consequences is that this whole Aristotelian worldview, which puts everything together and makes sense of it, is just doesn't work anymore. And you've just found one reason why. Right? The one reason why, and that's why Copernicus was so important, because Copernicus was the first modern. The Greeks also thought this. Greeks thought it all before. The Copernican model was so rejected for 200 years, pretty much. 1500 he proposed the idea in the 1500s. It wasn't until the 1700s that it was fully accepted. Because it goes against common sense. It goes against the understanding of being of the medievals. And I'd like you to absorb this change and how we laugh. When it's actually portrayed to us, we laugh. That's our response. We laugh at what the medievals thought. And yet, you see, to a future humanity, they're going to laugh at us. if we last that long. Yeah? Our current understanding is going to be the same kind of joke. I mean, first up, we didn't think that. We thought Newton got it right, because suddenly it explains everything. But in order to explain everything, we had to change utterly our understanding of matter. And we had to think of it in terms of points of mass distributed in space, controlled by forces, particularly the force of gravity. And this was, you know, the myth of Newton watching the apple and seeing the moon. I hope you get it. It was quite a long way into my life before I got it. He saw, because already we knew about inertia, that the tendency for things to keep on moving in a straight line. But you see, the thing about the moon is if it's moving around the Earth and it's a piece of matter, a piece of earthly matter, then if it's moving in a straight line, it should just go, see you later. Yes? Why doesn't it go, see you later? It doesn't do that because there's another force emanating from the centre of the Earth that is exactly balancing the tendency of the moon to go off in a straight line, which is what it would do if the Earth wasn't there. The Earth is pulling the moon back and causing it to fall in a curve. But what happens, because the Earth is round, is that the curve that it falls in, it just keeps falling in. Because there's no up or down for the Earth, right? It's just in a continual state of falling around the Earth. And in a way that the force of its movement, its inertial movement to go in a straight line, is exactly balanced by the force of attraction to the Earth. And so long as something is moving fast enough to begin with, so long as something has sufficient inertial straight line motion, then it will get captured by the gravitational force of a body like the Earth, and it will start falling. And that's all the moon's doing, it's just falling. It's just falling and falling, and falling and falling.
And the Earth as well, it's falling.
The Earth's falling around the sun.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see what a feat of imagination it would take to see that? No empirical experiment whatsoever, right? Just a kind of a brilliant vision. Suddenly, I've got it. No more spheres, no more celestial matter, no more, the whole Aristotelian story just goes, like Shakespeare, you know, at the end of The Tempest. We are but stuff upon which dreams are made. Do you know the whole thing? It's just a dream. That was just a dream. The whole Aristotelian thing was just a dream. Suddenly Newton comes along and says, it's just a dream. Do you see? It's not like that at all. It's like this. And everybody goes, my God, it's like this. And really believed it. As in, Newton has got a phone line to God. right? And we were still believing in God, right? God, this is the way God made things, and Newton's realized it. Amazing. And everybody just goes along and says, yeah, well, Newton's the thing, until the Michelson-Morley experiment, right? So we start to look into the speed of light, and the speed of light then starts to become weird, because Newton's projection is that we're laid out in this eternity of fixed space and fixed time, and gravity operates in this coordinate of pure space and pure time, which doesn't change. Yes, and in that world of forces, I hope you don't mind going into this. It's very fascinating if you haven't heard it before. You know, if anything's moving in this world and emitting light, like emitting anything, right? You'd expect the fact that it's moving to affect its emission. If light's like some kind of particle, like some kind of photon, off it goes, pching, right? At what we would call the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, yes? But in fact, this thing here, I mean, in the Michelson-Morley experiment, it was thought of as the Earth, right? This is moving, say, at 2,000 miles an hour, yes? So you'd expect light, the particle being fired off it, to be moving at 186,000, 1,000 miles per second, plus the 2,000 miles an hour, whatever that is in miles per second, on top of it. Yes, so the light should be going a little bit faster. And the light coming out the back, relative to you, you know, behind it, it will have its speed. Its relative speed will be as you would expect it if you were throwing a stone. You know, if you're on a train and you throw a stone and the train's travelling at 200 miles an hour and you throw a stone off the front of it, then it's going to be 200 miles an hour plus what you've given it. But when you measure the speed of light, if it's like a stone being thrown off a train, it doesn't travel at 186,000 miles an hour plus the speed with which you're travelling. It always travels at 186,000 miles per second, regardless of the movement of the thing that's emitting it. Now, that's just a fact of the Michelson-Morley experiment, but it's a bit like what happened when they observed that Aristotelian science wasn't working. That one experiment, that one little experiment said space and time and particles and photons and this whole atomic view of there being stuff in this fixed space and time doesn't work. It's not true. Although it's very good at making predictions, right? Because one of the first things that it turned out was that I think the orbit of Saturn or Jupiter, according to Newton's mathematics, wasn't as you would expect. It was being influenced by some other body, meaning some other planet. So they actually calculated that there must be another planet outside of the orbit. Which one is Saturn further out than Jupiter? This is again, very poor schooling, very poor schooling. This is stuff you were supposed to remember. Google, I know what we say, Google will tell us. Anyway, the Newton's equations predicted there was a planet, and there it was. And that was a kind of like, well, he has to be right then, doesn't he? He has to be right. But similarly, Einstein comes along, and the whole notion of absolute space and time and our whole understanding of the way things work here, that one experiment broke it. And Einstein then had to think of an entirely new understanding of space and time in order to accommodate that experiment. And Newtonian physics went, psh, a dream just like Aristotle's, only a slightly more powerful dream, because it enabled us to predict things that actually are there, like the planet Neptune, for example, but much more than that. You know, Newtonian science gave us the power to predict, in some sense, it was more correct about certain aspects of nature than the previous model. But it was still only a dream, still only a model, still only a certain projection of the being of beings, a projection of points of mass in space and time. Can't be like that, right? Einstein realizes that it seems that everything has to be actually made of fields, not particles. But quantum mechanics has another view, and we know for a fact, a mathematical fact, that quantum mechanics and relativity contradict each other. So the only advantage that 20th century science has, if it was conscious, is the knowledge that it's not like Newtonian science. We know it's a model, and we know that it only stretches so far. But the dream hasn't died. The dream of science is the theory of everything. That, oh yeah, okay, so relativity only covers that, quantum mechanics only covers that, but there's still the theory of everything, which will tell us, which finally will arrive at the ultimate. You know, that the impulse of science is still the same impulse, which says this particular projection that we have of material, Einstein's relativity didn't destroy that, because Einstein's relativity is still mathematical. That's why it's important to come back to Heidegger's reflection and Husserl's, because they both recognise that despite the revolution in science in the 20th century, we destroyed Newtonianism, but the basic framework of mathematical science remains. That basic, that this something of the projection was got rid of, but the basic character of it still remains. The basic character of it being, it's still something that has been abstracted from one's immediate experience, and has, in some sense or other, remains unable to account for that original immediate experience. The projection can't account for our being conscious. Even though modern physics says our observing affects the result of the experiment, but nobody's quite clear whether our observing means our being conscious or just the objective fact of there being an interference. Yes. The observation in one level is just, in order to observe anything at the very lowest level of physics, we have to change it. Do you see? You can see the world, and you think you haven't changed it at this level. But what's actually happening is we're picking up the way things are by bouncing photons off them. Yes, and then all kinds of stuff happens in our nervous system. But when you get down at the lowest level, if you bounce a photon off something, then you change it. Yes? So how can you observe anything? You can't be a little man sitting saying, oh, there's an electron. How can you possibly know there's an electron? Well, you have to bounce something else off it, right? And if you bounce something else off it, you change it. So how can you possibly come into contact with the thing itself?
And that's Whitehead.
Well, Whitehead understands quantum mechanics much better than me. That's a very simplistic kind of picture of why we're there's an indeterminacy for us once we get down to these ultimate constituents of what we can observe. That still doesn't necessarily implicate us as consciousness. It's just saying that all we can ever know about the reality at this level is by means of experiments that change it. Yes, so our observations are always implicated in what we know. We don't know what they're... It's like saying, well, we don't know what the stuff's doing when we don't observe it. Yeah? And what it's doing when we don't observe it is it appears to be very odd. It appears to be doing many things at the same time. And if we think there are things like particles, it appears that the particle that we observe when we make a measurement, before we make a measurement, actually was in several places at once. As soon as we make a measurement, it sort of says, oh, all right, I'm here. And that is still a conundrum for physics to be able to explain, well, what's, you know, because physics thinks it's talking about the real reality. And yet the real reality, in some sense, recedes from it. Almost to the point where, David Bohm, who's probably the most enlightened physicist, has just come to recognise that's how we are, that's how it is for us here. There's going to be no theory of everything. We can only get so far, you know, in our interrogation in this mathematical measuring approach to things. We can only get so far. There's always going to be what we can't reach. And not only that, within what we're endeavouring to do, which is to discover what we can that is measurable, which is another way of saying objective, we've already taken a certain course of action, a certain way of observing, where only what is measurable will show up as being real. Yes? So if something can't be measured, it's not going to show up.
But you are talking about really small things, aren't you? Tiny little...
Well, now, as far as physics is concerned, because I understand this... those small things are what's ultimately real. So there, those small things are it. It's not as if there are those small things and then there are these big things, because these big things are made of those small things.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah?
But like if you're trying to find out something like, oh, I don't know, what's the strongest fishing line? What's the best material to make a fishing line out of? I mean, you can do that kind of stuff without worrying too much about whether your observations will be affected by you observing them.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Checking.
Yes.
No, and also, Newton is valid in many things on Earth. For example, you want to know how long you will take to travel from one place to another, you apply the Newton formulas and are valid.
Yes. But that's always the case. That it's not that the predictions and the science is wrong. It's correct within a certain boundary or domain.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing again. It's this absolutization that says it's true for all and everything, for all eternity and all time. And there are no bounds to this knowledge. Which science continually falls into this error. Or scientists do, that thinking their knowledge is in some sense absolute. Now, the point being, it's not really that, you see, the thing that happens, especially for science and scientists and for us, is something like we're saying here. We predict that there's a new planet outside the orbit of Saturn and Jupiter, and there is. So that means, in the sort of subconscious of the human mind, that Newton's projection of the being of beings is correct. And it doesn't mean that. Because his projection, you see, although Newtonian physics is true within certain boundaries, there was a projection of being, and it was that Newton's projection of being wasn't made in a a hypothetical way, the early science was saying, no, this is how things are. And how was that projection? What was it? What did it say? It said all natural bodies are essentially of the same kind. Now, that means it's all made out of corpuscles or atoms or whatever. As we carry on, we refine that. But Newton had no right to say that. Do you see? He's making a guess.
Maybe.
Well, what about dark energy, dark matter? You know, we're still. If the maths goes wrong, then the physicists are not shy about inventing a whole other kind of stuff. And not just that. I mean, the latest thinking philosophically is that maybe something like panpsychism is true, and that the little atoms and molecules have some kind of experience. You know, we're actually, there's many ways that we could, for Newton and Descartes, there was a projection of matter as being dead, lifeless, having no inner qualities within itself, nothing like experience, and also nothing like an urge to fall to the ground. Yes, what could have been the interiority of being matter was denied. Denied. Why was it denied? Because we can't measure that. Yes. So because, in a way, we're saying because we can't measure it, it ain't there. Yes. But you see, it's an enormous punt. Let's try it. Let's try it out. Are you getting the idea of a projection of a certain understanding of being that had no justification in itself? It's just a way of understanding things, like a game. It's saying, well, let's try it and see where it goes. Because we try the game and what it results in is 20th century, 21st century technology, it's a bit like discovering Neptune. We say, well, it had to be true. And the answer is, well, why is it true? And the answer to that is, let me show you Hiroshima in 1945. Yeah? That's the kind of argument that our little human bodies and brains find very convincing, isn't it? Unless we deny it. It's fake news. This didn't happen. It's all made up by the Japanese. You know, it'll be... if that hasn't come already, it's probably... You know, like the moon landing didn't happen. It was all...
Oh, yeah.
It was Stanley Kubrick. He did it in a studio. It's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
So the Newtonian revolution... It just flattens all of being. And this is a Heideggerian term, the flattening of being. It's basically saying the whole universe and everything in it is made of matter. There's no earthly, fiery, airy, celestial. It's all just the same stuff spread out in space. And all that determines it are these basic forces. Now, nuclear quantum physics and relativity are still there with that. They've changed their mind about the absolute coordinates of space being unchanging. Space is in some sense combined with time in a mathematical manifold that we can't even envisage. But it's still basically the same. It's the same dead stuff spread out in this spatio-temporal manifold, obeying basically mathematical law. And that the universe came into being like that, and all of the laws that are going to determine its subsequent evolution just appeared it's a miracle, but we aren't, it's that there are people who make jokes about this. But at least there's only one. Yeah, there's a rather than in Christianity, there's a whole bunch of miracles needed. There's only one needed in this particular view of the world. It's the
Big Bang.
There it goes. Not just the Big Bang, but all the laws that define how the universal gravitational constant. There are all these the way that the forces evolve and interact. It can all be reduced down to this terribly simple mathematical expression that then determines how the universe is going to evolve from there on. It's all born with Newton, it's in a way of thinking that is already assumed in advance. I mean, in a way, everything that has been denied by saying that matter is like this was thrown into this other basket, which became the subjectivity of us. And for Descartes, he even denied anything. To keep it simple, he just said, and only the humans have it. The animals don't, the plants don't, the rest of life doesn't, just us. That's nice then, because science can be can carry on and investigate this realm, and we have this other realm that we'll deal with later. And part of the history of science is, well, that realm, the realm of our consciousness, of our being conscious that we deal with later, well, that later is arrived. Yes, we're now having to deal with it, but we're dealing with it still according to this old science. And the first way that we dealt with life, the first real inroad that what we would call materialistic or mechanical science step, the first step it took, was dear old Darwin. That was when science, if you like, this exact mathematical science, it went from physics to chemistry, and its next domain is life. How does science understand life? Answer: biology. So in this story we have to encounter biology before we get sort of fully into our modern worldview, because we're Newton was still believed in God. Right, we've got a new kind of God, a Protestant God, if you like, emerge with Newton. And the Protestant God made the whole thing, set the clockwork universe in motion. But he still placed us in it. Yes, God created the universe and basically set it up as this perfect mathematical machine. And then but it's not entirely a machine. He placed us with our eternal, you know, with our souls and our salvation.
It's deism.
Yes, it's called deism. So God certainly, it wasn't that science was materialistic with Newton. Newton just made a certain kind of projection that Descartes then fixed. You know, Newton's job was really to say, I propose that it's like this. And within that, I haven't stopped believing in God, because Newton's going to say, maybe with some right, because of course, nothing comes from nothing. This didn't just come from nowhere. At that point, the belief was that the universe, in some sense, this universe is eternal. There wasn't a Big Bang theory. It was just, this is God is eternal, and the universe is eternal, and these are the laws that God laid down for how the universe is. And then God placed us in this universe. Why? To enact the drama of our salvation. Yes?
Yeah.
Still had a purpose, it still had a meaning. And anyone who wants to question that, you at that point you would say, well, of course there was a God. Where do you come from? And where do all the animals come from? And where do all the plants come from? And the whole way that they fit together and they interact, the whole amazing harmony of it, how did that all occur? Obviously, there was a creator God. I mean,
It's like ad hoc.
It's not ad hoc. It's just the if you observe nature in any kind of detail, you're just confronted with the extraordinary, miraculous intricacy of it all. That you can explain the movement of the planets by Newton's law of gravity, but that doesn't explain where life came from. And neither did Newton think it would or expect it to. You know, it was fully accepted at that point that this is mechanics, as it was called, and its intent is to explain the mechanical aspects of the universe, not life on Earth. But what I feel like saying, but wait, there's more to come. I've still got 5 minutes, so there is more to come. Yes, I feel like I do have to finish this lecture, you see, because the very aspect, the deeper aspect, and I mentioned this earlier, of Newton's project, and Galileo's as well, the mathematical side of it, was that the first laws were axioms. They were the basic first principles upon which everything else was based. And this is how mathematics works. This is how...
Science as well.
Yeah, this is how Euclid's geometry works. You basically, when you do mathematics, you set up a certain mathematical field that you're going to study by defining axioms, the principles which define that field. And then you use logic to deduce from those axioms all the properties of the field. Now, Newton has said, OK, I'm going to propose the axioms of the universe.
Principia Mathematica.
Yes, Principia Mathematica. I'm going to propose the basic axioms upon which the entire mechanics of the solar system and of all of the behaviour of bodies on Earth, I'm going to propose the axioms on which they're based, and then I'm going to deduce from them entirely logically and mathematically what follows from those axioms. And what follows from those axioms is all of the behaviour of all of the matter that we see around us. And it does, to a certain degree, as Boris was saying, to a certain degree of approximation. But now, do you see the project?
Because the formula, all the formulas of Newton are valid because with Einstein, needed to have a multiply a square root of 1 minus the speed over the speed of the light. That means always that factor on Earth was 1. Then the formula was
yes.
Good.
It was only locally relevant.
Locally,
like, yes. 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 But do you see the overall approach? This is the Aristotle and the medieval science didn't jump over things and say, well, these are the axioms which define how the universe works. That science said, no, we'll just generalise from experience.
Everyone has borders.
Yes. Whereas modern science says, no,
people
forget experience. Right? I'm going to go and I'm going to say, I already think that the universe is essentially determined by mathematical principles, and my job is to divine the mathematical principles on which the universe operates. And Newton, in stroke of genius, says, and here they are. And if we accept those as true, we just now turn the handle. That's why it came to be called the mechanical universe, because you could deduce the movement of the planets, but not just that, you could deduce how long it will take something that you drop to fall to the ground. You could deduce everything. You just needed a special kind of mathematics to do it, which became differential calculus. So Newton was such a genius. Not only did he propose the axioms and say we could deduce behaviour from it, the mathematics of the day wasn't capable of working out the movement of bodies in, as they are accelerated and as forces act on them. That mathematics wasn't up to the job, so he had to invent a new mathematics that was able to calculate or predict the movement of bodies with forces acting on them. And that was calculus, something that by about the age of 16, I think calculus was dropped on me at about that age. But without, they never told me why, I mean, how terribly important it was. Because before then, the Greeks and Greek mathematics had been interested in the static pattern of things. Whereas Newtonian physics became interested in how things move, the rate of acceleration of something, the velocity of something, how the orbits of the planets work requires special kind of mathematics that Kepler first glimpsed, because the planets accelerate and decelerate in their orbits. They don't just go around in circles, they go around in ellipses. So a whole new kind of mathematics was needed to back all this up, and Newton developed that as well. So you see, he was a god, even though Leibniz independently developed calculus.
How people in those days were so prolific? Is it possible, like, are there people now?
Well, no, the thing is that the whole, whenever an entire worldview breaks down, then suddenly you can be incredibly creative. Do you know, and a whole new vista opens up. And in a way, because I've worked in science, I know this. Nobody's thought there before. So it's like there are all these low-hanging fruit, these ideas are just sort of hanging at the bottom of the tree, just within reach. And you're the first one on the scene, you know, and down you pluck it, and you say, and you've made this amazing discovery. 200 years later, thousands of people have been combing it all over in immense detail, and all the low-hanging fruit has gone. And you have to climb this enormous tree, and there's a tiny little, you know, tiny little apple, and you manage to pluck it and write a paper, and everyone says, oh, that's quite interesting. Do you know, but the actual effort you put in there to get to the top of the tree to pluck the tiny little apple of this tree of knowledge is equivalent to Newton, you know, who opened the whole, you know, he was one of the people who opened the door. And like the Greeks were in a similar position, where it's almost like the fruit was just lying for them. I mean, obviously, that's not to say you had to be extremely talented as well, but it's not that we aren't still extremely talented human beings. It's that it all depends as well on the times, yeah, in which you live.
Maybe more free time.
Oh yeah, and yeah. There's a lot of people in academia now say that there's no time to, but that's really not true. You know, Einstein was working in the patent office when he developed the special theory of relativity. You know, there are certain people, I think, whether they've got the time or not, or anything like that, who, if the time's right, it's almost like the idea. I don't want to say anything definite here. It's like the idea is waiting. Its time has come. Yeah, and somebody is going to find it. And quite often, you'll find that two or three people, like Darwin's idea of evolution, somebody else had it, Wallace, I think, before him, but didn't publish it. The idea is almost a consequence of the breakdown of the previous ideas. They almost suggest the new idea. But it takes someone to really pause, you know, and I think only a few people are capable of taking the pause in order to see something new. But it's very much like we were saying earlier, when you have an idea like Newton did, I bet you he would say, well, it was already there. Do you know? It was like it was already in me, like the Tau Mathematica is. The idea was already there. I had a problem there, and I just lived with it. How am I going to explain the orbit of the moon? And the answer just arrived. Not as a result of me inventing it, but as a result of me just looking at the problem. And I think this is, we all have this capacity in us.
It's a matter
of how you're going to articulate. Yeah, and Newton was just the right man at the right place at the right time. You know, Cambridge, great, you know, in England in the 17th century. So he was with the right education and everything came together. But history is a mysterious thing, isn't it? Why something happens, when and where it does. It all looks like it had to happen once it's happened, but you're never able to predict it. All right. There's been looking at the clock, and we've got to number 11.
We have minus 5 minutes.
Minus 5 minutes. Yes, but that was an important thing I wanted to talk about, because there's going to be a whole discussion of Descartes and what Descartes was doing, this idea of the axiomatic. See, that hasn't gone. See, this is where Heidegger's into it. He's going deeper into it now. He's saying the mathematical, it all looks like differential calculus, you know, algebra, and the mathematical techniques. But underneath, there is this mathematical approach that says, I propose the first principles and deduce everything from it. I mean, I'd like to express to you that we're under the sway of that kind of thinking in our understanding of the universe, even though we don't engage in it ourselves. Do you know it's? And if you look at it straight in the face, it's quite extraordinary that we should think that way. It's not at all obvious. I find the whole Aristotle is much more natural. And we could have developed another kind of science as well.
The first empiricist.
But you know...
Aristotle.
Pardon?
Aristotle was one of the first empiricists.
Yes, but... I would say that all peoples are empiricists to a certain extent. Just to be able to get around your environment, you know, you have to be empirical and learn from experience is really what that means, isn't it? You wouldn't be able to catch animals, you wouldn't be able to get food. You know, there's a certain basic empiricism in our just our natural way of being. It's when it becomes a consciously followed principle that it becomes something like science. All right.
That's like when empire starts. They start with the spirit of empiricism, and then they develop rules, and these rules don't fit the times of the empirical world, and the empire falls.
It's about looking back on those different screens, you know.